Want to track Anthony Peake's work? Just get to his website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. If it's a little slow, it's because so many people are looking at it right now. We're going to come back with him, talk a little bit more about his work, and take your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Anthony Peake with us. We'll get to your calls in a second. Anthony, in your work, of course, The Immortal Mind, that you wrote with Professor Laszlo, you talk about, of course, the Akashic field, the zero-point field. We talked about it briefly. Let's get into that a little bit more. What is that?
Okay. The Akashic field, just going back a little time in history, for many years in the late 19th century, there was a real issue in science as to how light waves propagated through space, because space is a vacuum. And for many years, they suggested something called the luminiferous ether, that is the light-bearing ether, which is the idea that there was some kind of a substance that we couldn't actually detect out there in space that carried light waves for us, because, of course, a wave has to have a medium to travel within. Now, Michelson and Morley did an experiment, I think, in around about 1887 to disprove that this ether existed. And, of course, Einstein again came along and actually said, you can get around this issue by arguing that light is not a wave, it's a photon, it's a particle. And, of course, wave-particle duality is one of the big issues in science, and I discuss this in great detail in my books. But suffice to say, what they've actually found is that there was something that was suggested called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And in effect, this means for a subatomic particle, there's certain amounts of information you cannot know about a subatomic particle. You can either know its location or its speed or its velocity, but you can't know both. Now, going back to the idea of absolute zero at 272.15 degrees below zero, or zero Kelvin, is where effectively energy stops moving. Everything stops moving. It is so cold, there's no movement, no anything. And I think I'm right in saying that space itself is around about 3 degrees above that, because of the cosmic background radiation. But effectively, space is slightly higher than the coldest you can possibly get. But we're in the position now that we can take, and we can take in within laboratory conditions, take things down to just above absolute zero. And what they found when this happens, when there should be no energy available, all the subatomic particles have stopped moving, there's no energy, no thermal energy or anything, there is still energy there. There is still something, and there's something called, I think it's helium-3 or helium-4, it's one of the two, which actually remains liquid even at that level. So scientists have concluded that there is a form of energy that actually exists within the quantum vacuum. There's this form of energy that is everywhere. Now, if this is the case, it means that space is not empty. It's not a vacuum. It's the opposite. It's a plenum. It's full of this energy force. Now, there have been people such as Bernard Haitch and various other scientists who've been researching what we can do about this zero-point energy. Is there any way we can draw it up and use it as a new form of energy? But the other intriguing thing about zero-point energy is it's almost replaced the ether. It is the backdrop of everything. It's everything that's everywhere. It's everywhere inside us and around us and everything else. And there is a belief that this energy, this form of energy, the zero-point field and the zero-point energy itself, is similar to, for instance, the big issue of the last few year or so has been the discovery of the Higgs boson. And again, the Higgs field is something similar again. It's the idea that there is a field, an ocean. And this ocean can carry information, what Professor David Bohm called information. It's an information field. It is effectively the hard drive by which the universe works. Now, what Irvin Laszlo has suggested in his amazing book, Science and the Akashic Field, An Integral Theory of Everything, is exactly how this, the zero-point field, is the equivalent of the Akasha, which is the Akashic field, the Akashic record that you actually get in the Vedas and you get it in the Eastern religions and Eastern belief systems. And this is the thing that everything comes out from, and everything we perceive comes out from there. Now, this is a very, very powerful argument because there's been recent work done, and it has been suggested by somebody called Craig Hogan at, I think it's the Boundary Institute. And effectively what they're saying is that due to certain ways in which black holes function, which I won't go into detail now because I haven't got time, but effectively the universe itself is surrounded. The universe is a huge expanding sphere, okay? And at the edge of that sphere are what are kind of little 2D projectors at the Planck length, and they are projecting 2D images into the universe itself, which is creating a three-dimensional image, which is a hologram. And this is what the universe is. And this universe, this holographic universe, is being drawn up from the zero-point field. I hope that made sense. It was very difficult to put it succinctly in what takes a whole book to explain. But effectively, that's what we're arguing.
It's amazing. The way that you have bridged science, physics, theology, spirituality, the paranormal, you've put it all together.
I know. I mean, I sometimes sit back and go, wow, well, why me? How did I do this? And of course, Irvin Laszlo has been profoundly influential on my work. But I also spin off, I've written a book on time and time perception as well, because I believe there's too much silo thinking going on there. And in our field, you know, the field that you and I and our listeners are interested in here, there's an awful lot of wishy-washy nonsense out there. But the science is there. It's just pulling it together. In my argument is people have extraordinary experiences. People have had extraordinary experiences since the beginning of time. And because they don't fit in with our scientific model, they're ignored. You know, it's like the explanation of déjà vu. Déjà vu, oh, it's visual pathways theory. It's an aberration within the neurochemicals in the brain. Well, maybe people are in some way remembering they lived in the past. Maybe they are recognizing information that is yet to take place. Let's listen to what people experience, because scientifically, empiricism means from experience. Let's listen to people. Let's not use the old diktat that the plural of anecdote is not proof. Well, in my opinion, to a certain extent, it is. If everybody has the same experience, like deja vu, the near-death experience, the out-of-body experiences, these are consistent. These are consistent across cultures and across time. These things are real experiences. Let's start looking at them, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Okay, let's take some calls here. Bob is in Greenwood, California, and he'll be our first with Anthony Peake. Go ahead, Bob. Good to have you with us.
Good evening. Hi, really interesting conversation. I just wanted to pretext my statement with the idea that I'm agnostic about most of what's being said. I really enjoy the conceptualization of it. I wanted to speak specifically to what we were talking about with the neurological point. I'm a retired Department of Defense executive, retired when I was about 49 years old. They discovered I'd been epileptic my whole life. My entire life I'd had experiences where I would wake up in places and have no idea how I got there. And then as I got later in life, I would really have serious ones. And then in 2010, after they determined I'd been epileptic, they determined that I have this ability during a post-seizure fugue state to do incredible things. I drove 7 miles in a car that I don't remember, drove off a cliff, got thrown from the car, broke my neck, my back, a hole in my head, lived through that. What it taught me was the sensitivity of the neurological part of my brain in terms of memory. It's incredible. I will have series of like 5 or 6 seizures at a time. And then when I wake up, the places where I'm at, I'll have no idea how I got there. But the people I'm looking at, it will feel like they were in a restaurant I managed 25 years ago. And so my point is that the neurological aspect of it, as you were saying, the neurochemical, and then when you have an event like that occurs to you, it's a very strange experience to realize that you can be an actual different person. I was put in the hospital at the end of last year for a study on my brain, and we tried to explain to the hospital that I have this post-seizure fugue ability, and they kind of laughed, said, yeah, you'll be watched. Well, it turned out I had a seizure. It gave me enough time to take all of the probes off of my head, all of the chest probes off, and find me 3 stories up in the 5th floor of the hospital trying to take a screen out of the window and step out of the window. I have absolutely no memory of any of those things, but yet they happen regularly throughout my life if I have those seizures, and I never knew I was having them until the age of 49.
How could this happen, Anthony? I know you're...
Well, interestingly enough, I'm at the present moment in time, I'm doing a business contract to an epilepsy charity. And I'm in the fortunate position of being able to talk to some of the world's leading researchers in epilepsy and read a lot of the latest research papers.
No memory.
And I'm particularly fascinated by the fugue state. Indeed, I'm fascinated by a lot of the pre-seizure aura states that people who have epilepsy, particularly temporal lobe epilepsy, experience, but also the absence states, the petit mal states where people actually go into absence seizures, and where consciousness goes when this happens. And it's as if a second consciousness, as the gentleman's just been explaining, it's as if there's a second consciousness takes over that has motive force, that has motivations to go somewhere and do things, but can do extraordinary things. Now, this suggests to me that in those circumstances, something else takes over. You know, there is the idea that we are more than one personality. But, you know, when you have the multiple personalities analysis, which I discuss in great detail in my first book, the idea that, you know, there are very many areas of consciousness, conscious knowledge, and self-referential knowledge. And again, citing the example here, there are a couple of examples here that I will just touch upon very quickly. Something called alien hand syndrome, where people who have had a stroke, where one part of one hemisphere of the brain has been dislocated in some way, will have experiences where their left hand or their right hand will have motivations completely different to the motivations within the head. So, for instance, a woman who's had a stroke, and this is very much cited by people like Oliver Sacks, will decide that she wants to wear a particular dress one day, and the other hand will grab out and grab another dress. And again, this was evidenced again by the Michael Gazzaniga and Roger Sperry operations on individuals who had epilepsy. And again, they found that they discover two or more personalities inside the head, which can manifest under certain circumstances. For instance, I cite the example of the very famous young man called P that is cited by Sperry and Gazzaniga. And these are intriguing things, and it shows that the brain is effectively a tuner. For consciousness, it's a receiver, and in which case, when the signal is lost from one particular part of the zero-point field or the intelligence field that surrounds us, we get lost within it. And indeed, this is exactly what people like Stuart Hammerhoff, who is a anesthesiologist at the University of Arizona, has been arguing for years. Hammerhoff is fascinated by the fact that when we take a total anesthetic and we anesthetize the brain, consciousness disappears completely. It goes, you know, that there is a segue, it just goes. So clearly what is going on in our head is far more complex. And the listener here is really citing some incredible examples, which, by the way, I'd like to hear more of. And if you're interested in joining me on my Facebook site, I'd be interested to know more about this, because my next book is going to be about epilepsy. So I'm very important that anybody out there, like the gentleman here, who experiences extraordinary experiences under epileptic states or aura states, please contact me.
Anthony, I'm in conflict with the state of mind, the physical state of mind, and then the consciousness, which doesn't seem to be attached to the brain at all. What's the difference there? Well, I mean, it really is frustrating to put the two together.
Well, there is the argument, isn't there? Neurologically, there are two things going on in the brain. There's very much the sensory motor parts of the brain where we react automatically to stimuli. So effectively, it is very much almost the reptilian brain, the more automatic parts of us. And there is the higher functioning parts of the brain. And there seems to be this overlap of these kind of visceral reactions to circumstances. The more animalistic part of us, and then there's the more rational part of us. But sometimes that rational part can be disassociated from the normal body. It gets lost in some way. And in fact, you know, there's a guy I met a few years ago called Thomas Sheridan, who's been writing about psychopaths. And again, the idea here where we have dislocation from empathy, we have dislocation in other ways. The human brain is a phenomenally complex, as somebody once said, it's the most complex thing in the universe, but it has its issues. And just like a radio can attune wrongly or can malfunction in some way, because remember, we are slaves to our neurochemicals. The neurochemicals within the brain, the dopamine pathways, the various other pathways, can change our mood radically. As we know, when we take certain types of drugs, they can change our concept of reality totally. Now, does this mean that the external reality is really out there as we perceive it, or do these substances change the way we perceive things totally? They open up channels. They open up the doors of perception.
All right, next up, let us go to Tammy in Florence, Oregon. Tammy, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, Tammy.
I'm the one that got shot in the head. Anthony, I have a lot of questions for you, too many for this show. One of them is, before I got shot, I knew it was going to happen. Before my little brother John got crushed between a log loader and its carrier, I called home to try and stop it.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Before my dad had a brain tumor in the lower right side of his head, and the doctors told him they could not operate, which is the part of the brain that the bullet took out on me, and no scientist will take me in as a study, a live study. They all want me dead before they'll even touch my brain, which, in my opinion, sir, they've studied enough of them and got it wrong.
Why won't they do that, Tammy?
The only issues I have is when we have the geometric pressure or storms, I have major migraine headaches, and I can't feel heat.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you have precognitions. Do you have inklings? Do you have a sensation that something's going to happen, or do you physically know?
I know things are going to happen before they happen. I know when, and I know where. I woke up. I told my dad the morning I got shot I was going to get shot. Now, I'm writing a book about this, so I'm not going to go too much into it.
Okay.
The night before we realized that something was wrong with him, I woke up, first time in my life, I was visiting my parents, you know, but I ended up having to stay there after I got shot, screaming for my mother, who her and I never had the relationship me and my daddy had. She came in. I told her I'd seen a coffin over dad's bed, and he had a brain tumor. The next day, my dad's eyes were so enlarged, they looked like they were going to pop out of his head. My mother called the ambulance. The ambulance came in and told me that 2 more hours, we would have lost him.
So he survived
because of
your prior knowledge.
Because I'd caught it at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow. Because this, again, a classic example, Tammy, really. I would argue that the higher self within you is far more attuned and far more aware and far more communicative and is therefore able to warn you of events that are going to take place because it has already experienced your life before. And for some reason, there is something in your neurological constructs that allow those communication channels, those doors of perception, to be open.
No.
Now, two things that I think are important. The first one is that you must write down when you have these experiences and have witnesses to the fact that you've had a precognitive experience, because that is gold to people like me. Because for years I've been saying to people, please, we need the smoking gun. But even when you have the smoking gun, people will still deny it and say it's coincidence.
We'll talk about the second thing for Tammy and take final calls when we come right back. Well, next hour, Stephen Bassett joins us with the latest on the citizens' hearings for disclosure. I'm looking forward to that. We're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls as well. Hey, you know, as you do know, our television program is called Beyond Belief. They've got an amazing promotion going on right now for 99 cents for 1 month. 99 cents for you to sample, experiment, and watch as many shows as you can. As a matter of fact, last year I interviewed Santa Claus. That should be available if you go through the archives. 99 cents. Simply go to our website, then it'll take you to a link, www.beyondbelief.com. Anthony, peek with us before we go off to other calls. So you had another point for Tammy that you wanted to mention. Anthony, do you want to do that?
Yeah, it was just the idea that it's very important that we keep records of such things. It's not just for Tammy, it's for anybody else out there. But if you have extraordinary experiences, particularly precognitions, please make a record of them, write them down, get witnesses to the fact, tell as many people as you can, and then we have a smoking gun to actually prove that precognition exists. I believe precognition exists because I know it exists. It's happened to me on occasions, and I know that most people out there have had precognitive experiences of one description or another. And by all means, if you've had any uncanny precognitive experiences that you have proof of, please contact me. I'm very keen to hear from you.
I would guess most people have had some kind of experience, 70-80% at least. What do you think?
I totally agree. The amount, I regularly lecture over here in the UK, and one my favorite part of my lectures is always at the end when I sit down in front of the stage and we just chat, and people come forward with experiences. And what I find is that people feel at ease if they know that people around them are not going to ridicule them. They're not going to put them down. They're going to listen sympathetically and analyze what's happening. It is incredibly common, and I think it is so common that we really need to wake up and smell the coffee on this. We need to revise our science to take into account these experiences and come up with explanations, because I feel somehow the truth is out there, as they said in the X-Files. It's just science is ignoring the welter of evidence because it doesn't fit in with the present paradigm. We need to change the paradigm. And I'd like to believe that people like myself and people like you, George, are the people that are facilitating that change.
Let's go to Bob in Taylor, Michigan now, east of the Rockies. Bob, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, George. It's good to talk to you again.
You too.
It's nice to talk to Dr. Anthony Peake also. Hey, you touched on a subject that's dear to my heart. I've been studying for the last 6 months about time travel, and you mentioned in a vacuum state. Well, I was on in July talking to Katie Fries, the director of physics at the U of M, and I tried to explain my theory about time traveling in this vacuum state, and I do believe that that the Earth, the galaxy is not expanding. It's actually in coming back in through a vacuum state, through the Big Bang hole, and that I believe that the galaxy is only 7.5 million light years old instead of 10 million light years old, which they all believe. And also about the premonitions. Mine usually come at night when I'm sleeping. I will wake up and have a premonition, but they always come at nighttime. Mm. Is that out of the ordinary, or?
No, that is intriguing. The reason being that there are two liminal states that we experience before we go to sleep. It's something called a hypnagogic state, and when we wake up, it's called a hypnopompic state. Now, both these states, I argue, again, in two or three of my books, these are the kind of the states where we're attuned far more to alternate realities. The brain itself is more open. It could be the release of particular neurotransmitters in the brain. I particularly suggest substances such as melatonin. There is also a very strong argument to say that DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is also released in the brain during these times, which means it opens up a portal. And for certain individuals, it allows you to actually visualize or see within these hypnagogic or hypnopompic images the future. And it seems as if you can kind of move outside of linear time, what Philip K. Dick would call orthogonal time, and you can see slightly in front of time and slightly behind. Now, again, this is not as curious as it seems. There is a lot of work being done now in terms of time and in terms of particles of time, which Michael Finkelstein actually jokingly called chronons. And there is an idea, for instance, and this again is not some crazed idea, this is something that was postulated by some very, very top scientists, including Stephen Hawking and various other individuals, that certain particles, antiparticles, positrons, are in fact electrons traveling backwards in time. Okay. Now, if this is the case, and Richard Feynman was somebody else that suggested this, so there is a possibility that time flow can reverse. Somebody called John Kramer has come up with something similar as well, in which case what we're talking about here is that sometimes we can attune to the future and we can get glimpses of it. The tragedy is we can't control it. We can't hold the images. Do you find that you can hold the images when you get the precognitions? Can you hold on to them, or do you just lose them as soon as you focus in on them?
Well, if I first wake up and write them down, then I can remember them. But if I don't, then they'll be lost.
Yes, exactly. And do you have ones that have actually come true, that you've had incidents where you've had something and it's then subsequently happened?
Yes, yes. I warned my sister not to go out because I believe that she was going to have a car accident. And at 12 o'clock, we were getting ready for church, and on a Sunday morning, and sure enough, my sister Paula called and said that Sis had been in an accident over on Van Born and Ecorse Road.
Know it well, and Bob. I know that intersection. Unbelievable to have that ability. So let me ask you this, Anthony, and Bob, thanks for the call. When people have this experience, again, are you saying that it's more of a past deja vu presence and life, and he's just recreating this? Or is it truly that little thing on his shoulder that says, hey, look out, there's going to be an accident?
Well, it's both. The little thing on his shoulder, as we call it, is my equivalent of Damon. The little thing on the shoulder is the part of him that has lived the lives many, many times before. It's the game player. And the game player, just like Lara Croft when she runs down the corridor and there's a monster there, the game player knows it, so makes it run in a different direction. It's the equivalent of that, where it's going, there's going to be an incident here. This time round, I don't want this to happen. I need to communicate with my Eidolon, my in-game Eidolon, to warn her or him to not do something or to take different actions. Now, how I do it depends upon how I can communicate, but I will warn, I'll give inklings, and I'll do everything else. Because effectively, I would argue that in a previous life, maybe not the last one, but one previous, that incident took place and somebody was killed or badly injured. In this iteration of what I call the Bonian IMAX, there's a whole background story to why I call it that, which I won't touch into. Maybe some other stage we could discuss that. But effectively, within the Bonian IMAX, you can then change the future. Now, it could also be that you might just remember anyway. Like, there are arguments for precognitive deja vu sensations, where somebody has a deja vu recognition of the circumstances they're in now because their Eidolon remembers, and then suddenly they know what's going to happen next because it was so traumatic last time that the memory resonates in some way. But if it's a huge computer program that contains everything, this is not at all surprising. It's just we don't open our minds to it in the right way, and I don't know the techniques for doing this. I have hypnagogic and hypnopompic imagery, and I've discussed this with a guy called Professor Andreas Mavromatis, who's the world's leading authority on hypnagogia and hypnopompia, and we both discussed how do you control them, and the answer is you can't, it seems anyway.
No, you really can't do that. Let's go to Dylan in Chicago, Illinois. Dylan, thank you for holding, and you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George and Anthony?
Good,
Dylan. Dylan.
Hey, thanks, guys. I got one question for you, Anthony. By the way, I find your theory remarkable here. It's actually very genius. For kids and children who, you know, are terminally ill or abortions and cases like that, how do you, you know, account for those type of cases? Do they just keep reliving that tragic, you know, death over and over again, or do they advance? You know, is there an opportunity for them? Is what I'm asking.
Well, this is a question that I've long wrestled with. You know, the idea of somebody who dies young, somebody who's born with a terrible disability or something of that nature, and how does this hypothesis work with that? And the only thing I can think of is that because there are so many multiverses, there's so many backstories. In other words, your parents had to have met for you to have been born. Their parents needed to have met, and in fact, going right through the centuries. So there could be circumstances, and the circumstances could be that certain illnesses or diseases or sets of circumstances bring about that essence, that engrounded daemon coming into this universe, in this universe, has those issues. But a different set of circumstances would mean that they didn't. In other words, there can be sets of circumstances where the child isn't aborted because the sets of circumstances are different or the rules are different or whatever. So that child survives in their universe. They don't necessarily survive in ours, but that doesn't mean that they don't get the opportunity to still fulfill their normal life. Now, if we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, we are all the same person in many ways. We are all part of the same greater something. Some people may call that God, you know, the collective consciousness and everything else. But it is a huge issue. But I always stress to people, you know, this is me analyzing what the evidence seems to tell me. In other words, I hadn't thought this is a great idea. Let's go and prove it by putting the science together. It's been quite the opposite. I never expected to come up with the cheating the ferryman model because that's not where I was intending to go. It's what the evidence told me. So it's very important to say there are elements of it I don't like at all. And I find it very, very frustrating that if the model does work that way, it's profoundly unfair. But remember, you don't live the same life over and over again. This is profoundly important. It's not a circle, it's a spiral. And it spirals upwards, or it can spiral downwards, if that makes any sense.
This evidence that consciousness could exist outside of the brain, to me, Anthony, has got to be one of the most fascinating aspects of all of this, of all of us.
Oh, totally. We, when Irvin and I decided to pool our resources to write the book, I did a considerable amount of research in evidence for consciousness outside of the brain. Now remember, if you read my first book, I'm very, very grounded in the book in the sense that I argue that consciousness is embedded in the body. In other words, at that stage in my career, as far as I was concerned, consciousness was an epiphenomenon of brain processes. If the brain didn't function, there was no personality, there was no person. But I have had to, over the years, completely revise my opinion on this by evidence that I have seen, that I have been told, were circumstances where people can see things that are outside of the body. I'll cite an example of this because it's my favorite example. There's a guy called Graham Nichols who contacted me because Graham read my books and said, you know, that there really is evidence for perceptions outside of the body. And he gave me an example, and he told me that way back in 1999, in April 1999, he had an experience whereby he was with friends, he was on a training course, and he collapsed. And he found himself in an out-of-body state, okay? And he found himself in the junction of Old Compton Street and Moore Street in London. Literally found himself standing there, outside of his body, just suddenly he was there. He saw somebody run past him down the street, and then he saw an explosion take place halfway down the street. People started staggering out covered in blood. He then heard a voice in the distance calling him, and it was the people in the training room calling him back. And he found himself dragged back out of his body, back to the lecture theater. When he came to, he turned around, he said, I've just seen something. There's going to be a terrorist attack in Soho, in London, soon. 5 days later, there was a bomb in the Admiral Benbow pub, which was exactly where he had been standing in his dream state. Now, this is a precognitive out-of-the-body experience. So this is not only he was outside of his body, but he was outside of his body in the future. Now, if you go onto my YouTube site, I've interviewed Graham standing at that point. So you can actually listen to the man himself explaining his experience. Graham has written a series of books on the out-of-body experience. Now, to me, this was inexplicable.
Yes.
Absolute.
And what makes somebody better than someone else with this ability?
Pardon?
What makes somebody better with this ability than somebody else?
I don't know. This is the thing, something, again, Graham and I have discussed. Sometimes it's not better than it. Sometimes circumstances happen. You know, when people have near-death experiences, a friend of mine, Penny Satori, Dr. Penny Satori is a researcher in near-death experiences. And she cited to me example after example of individuals who have been out of their body during near-death experiences, where they've been looking down at their body and actually, again, eliciting information that they couldn't possibly know. It's as if there's certain neurological, again, it comes down to neurochemistry, where it facilitates this, your consciousness goes out into the field. The field, the Akashic field, the zero-point field, whatever we want to call it, which is, again, evidence that we are not embodied beings. Our consciousness is, our brain is a receiver of consciousness. It doesn't create consciousness, like a radio doesn't create the concert orchestra that you listen to. When you switch the radio off, the concert orchestra is still there. When we die, consciousness is still there. It's just in a different form. And again, the evidence in my book, The Out-of-Body Experience, I go into great detail about this, and I cite many, many examples. And again, this is a classic example of me, again, changing my opinion based upon the evidence.
Let's go to John in Seattle. John, let's take it away. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight? Thanks for taking my call.
Good, John. Only about a minute, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Hey, I had an experience back in 99. I had an apartment on Queen Anne Hill, and I had a lot of paranormal things happening at this particular apartment, and I would always, I had a basement apartment, I always leave my front door open in the summertime. Well, one day, the door was open in the summertime, and again, and I went into my bedroom, I laid down, like, on my stomach and folded my arms under my head, and my head was facing the doorway, and within 5 seconds, I could see somebody standing in the doorway, just two legs, just the shadow of it. Okay. So, and I can, and now I'm freaking out, and I can sense that this person is going to mess me up. And I'm, so I get ready to make my move. And as soon as I did that, I get this pounding on my back, and I'm thinking, this guy's stabbing me, you know, and it was pretty traumatic. But he just kept stabbing, but I didn't feel the pain or any of that. But the thing is, all of a sudden it just was over with, and I got up, and I was just, you know, I was just freaked out. But I started noticing after that that everything, like my family, friends, everything had turned, like it was like a switch, like a notch had been turned back. Everybody was a little bit uglier in their attitudes, and it just...
Really? You seem to pick up the evil side of everyone. We are out of time. Anthony Peak, thank you so much. You have a great Christmas. Go check out his websites and his work. Absolutely amazing. We'll be back in a moment with Stephen Bassett on Coast to Coast AM.